Support for NHPR's The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Annie Ropeek, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. It's been 1 year since the coronavirus pandemic arrived in the state. Since then, we've seen more than 75,000 cases, 1,100 deaths, and more recently, tens of thousands of vaccinations every week. It's also been a busy week in state government, with controversy over offensive remarks from lawmakers during virtual legislative hearings, plus a new attorney general nominee and more debate about executive powers. But first, we'll spend this part of our show getting the latest on COVID-19 and vaccines, and we want to hear from you. Are you taking advantage of the state's mass vaccination site this weekend? What's been your experience scheduling or waiting for a vaccine? And what's on your mind as you find yourself back here in March yet again? Give us a call right now, 1-800-892-6477. You can use Facebook, tweet us, or email exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests for this part of our show. Nancy West is executive editor for In-Depth New Hampshire. Welcome, Nancy.
Good morning.
And I am so excited to have NHPR's new health and equity reporter, Ali Pham, on the show for the first time today. Ali, welcome.
Thank you. Excited to be here as well.
So beginning tomorrow, the state will have a new 211 option for people who are homebound to register for a vaccination. Governor Sununu also announced the state would start vaccinating Group 2A, which includes K-12 educators and childcare staff, later this month. And that's been broken down into two groups. Here he is talking about that first phase.
We're kind of taking a two-pronged approach with the 2A population. That's the teachers and school administrators and childcare workers. It will begin as early as next Friday, March 12th, as follows. So first, where possible, our regional public health networks will work in partnership with school officials to organize and schedule vaccination clinics for their populations to administer first doses in closed pods as early on and beginning on March 12th.
So, Nancy, what do you know about this closed pod system and what questions sort of remain about how that will work?
Well, I think a lot of the school districts have already been in touch with the state, have already, you know, it's not something they've been waiting to hear more about before they start planning. There are 13 regional public health networks that the schools will be partnering with to get started. And boy, is it an exciting time to think about getting everybody vaccinated in the state of New Hampshire by early summer. And that's something that Governor Sununu mentioned at the press conference Thursday. So I think the school districts are on top of this, and the state is also working with them. And the region there, I had no idea before that there are 13 regional public health networks. So they'll be getting very active this week.
So this is the first time we've heard those regional networks invoked during the pandemic?
It's the first time I've heard of it. And by having the closed pods, this will be, you know, for the school districts, the teachers, staff, people who are, who need to be part of that network. It's not open to, these aren't open to the public.
Sure. And so the second phase of vaccinating the 2A group, which Governor Sununu announced yesterday, is for communities and school districts that are unable or choose not to do closed pods.
Our state-hosted vaccine sites. Starting on March 17th, we will open up registration for vaccine appointments through the new state-run scheduling system, which will be unveiled kind of down the road a little bit. So March 17th, VMS opens to the K-12 schools.
So there's a lot there, Nancy. So first, what do we know about this new state-run vaccination registration site? We know that people in groups 1A and 1B are registering through the federal VAMS site. Why is the state switching to their own site here?
Well, when the federal system rolled out for the 1A, the other group, it really had a number of different problems, you know, and they had to really regroup the whole registration process and decided to create their own. So this is a new registration system, a new online registration system, and we don't know much about it. As Governor Sununu just mentioned, there will be more made available in about information about this system down the road. So we have to keep our fingers crossed. Often when there's a new rollout of a very large piece of technology, there can be some glitches, but I'm really feeling so optimistic about this rollout that, like I said, keep our fingers crossed and we will learn more soon.
Sure. And I mean, there are lots of questions and we want to hear your questions, listeners. We have Robin from Wilton calling now. Robin, you are on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. What's your question?
Hi. Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a professional nanny in home and I am just calling to find out if I will be eligible under the child care workers when it's time for their vaccination.
Robin, thank you. Nancy, what do we know about whether nannies and home child care workers are included in this next round?
I haven't heard anything about nannies. And the best place to get a question answered is to call the state at 211. Now, I've heard people say they've had a long wait on that telephone line, and I've called myself and waited a bit. And frankly, I had very good luck. I've waited much longer on other calls when I have to call about my Verizon bill. So I think that would be a good question.
Great. So, I mean, and we should note that we have an updated FAQ on vaccines at nhpr.org/coronavirus. We are keeping that posted with all of the new information that we learn about the state's vaccination program every day. So check back often there for updates. So, Nancy, we also learned yesterday that starting on March 22nd, people in the 2B group, which is residents over the age of 50, can also start registering for the vaccine through the state-run website as well. That's got to be a big group, right?
Yeah, that's going to be a large group. I know the teachers group and 2A is a group of 50,000 people. The 50 and older, I'm not exactly sure on the number, but they'll also be using the same statewide registration program.
Sure. And so, Allie, the state trying to kind of get up to speed on the big new demand for vaccines is hosting its first super site this weekend. That's a mass vaccination clinic that starts on Saturday at the New Hampshire Motor Speedway, by appointment only for people in the 1B group. What else should we know about that super site?
Yeah, absolutely. And super site it is. So the state is planning on vaccinating about 12,000 Granite Staters in this 3-day clinic. So it'll be Saturday through Monday. And the folks who go there, they're going to be getting the recently approved Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So big thing to note there is it is a one-shot vaccine. So unlike people who have been getting the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, these folks are going to be, you know, one and done. They're not going to have to come back for a second appointment. And Annie, you had just mentioned this is appointment only. And I just kind of want to touch on exactly how that's working.
Sure.
So the state has said that they've been reaching out to people who have appointments scheduled later on down the road. So a lot of folks with appointments scheduled in April, and essentially just offering them the opportunity to come to the Motor Speedway in Loudoun this weekend and get that shot there. And then another thing I want to note is just the location specifically at the New Hampshire Motor Speedway. So it's going to be drive-through and people really aren't going to have to, they're not going to have to get out of their cars at all. And then the owners of the New Hampshire Motor Speedway, they have tracks in other states and have already done mass vaccination clinics there. So, you know, hopefully that means good things for logistics, because this is, you know, the first time this state's done something of this size. So
sure. Yeah. I always like to note my parents live in Maryland and they got vaccinated at the Six Flags down there. So these mass sites are kind of incredible. I mean, do we know how many people the state is aiming to vaccinate this weekend?
Yeah. So they've said that they're expecting to vaccinate around 12,000 folks. And then we also don't really know at this point if there's going to be, you know, if there's going to be a lot of mass vaccination sites to come. It seems like that's going to be determined based on future allocations of the vaccine to New Hampshire, which is what the DHHS has told me. And they're really doing this weekend because the J&J vaccine was so recently approved that they kind of thought that this mass site was going to really just be the most efficient way to get those shots in arms.
Right. So you're planning to go to the Speedway this weekend to watch that process. What are you going to be looking for?
Yeah. So I think, you know, first off, just logistically, how is this working? Are people, you know, Governor Sununu yesterday had said, please don't show up more than 15 minutes early. So, you know, just going to see how it's running. And then, you know, most importantly, just I'm really hoping to talk to people there and see how this experience from start to finish goes for them.
Great. Allie, you are an old pro. We look forward to your coverage of the supersite. And Nancy, do you have any thoughts on the implications of this new supersite?
Oh, I think it's wonderful to be able to, in 3 days, be able to administer 12,000 shots. It's really going to be fantastic. I think the governor really tried to stress to our reporter, Paula Tracy, to only show up if you have an appointment. And I think they're trying to keep it so that it's at least trying to get that many people through in somewhat a manageable fashion.
Sure. And Nancy, we have a great question from a listener here. This person says they hope that this is a good way to ask this question. I'll move from group 2B to 1B on April 18th when I turn 65. What is my best strategy for getting a vaccination in a timely manner? Should I wait until I turn 65, then register as 1B? Will that put me in line in front of people who are up to 15 years younger than I am at that point? Nancy, what should this person do around their birthday?
Oh, I would just sign up as soon as possible. And one other thing that Sununu has been stressing is how quickly people who have perhaps signed up for an appointment in April or May are moving up. So the sooner you get registered, the better. And then, if possible, move up. As Allie was saying, the more vaccines that come into the state, the sooner people will get them in the arms.
And do you have any sense of the future of the J&J vaccine in the state or how supply is working and expanding kind of as we look out towards summer?
Well, it's it appears that this week the state received almost twice as many doses of vaccine than it had in previous weeks. And that looks like it's going to continue these increases. And I know President Biden mentioned that he thought everybody could be vaccinated by the end of May. Governor Sununu thinks that's optimistic. But even in New Hampshire, Governor Sununu is talking about having everyone eligible in the state for vaccinations to have them by the beginning of summer. That's coming right up.
Yeah. So, Nancy, I mean, you've been covering the coronavirus response from Governor Sununu for the past year. What has stood out to you just looking generally about how he's handled this crisis, about sort of how it's evolved over the past 12 months? What stands out to you about that?
Well, I think it's been quite a learning experience for everyone in the Department of Public Health, everyone in state government. In fact, everybody in the state of New Hampshire and probably the whole world. And it's really kind of interesting to watch how it's evolved and how people like Governor Sununu have stepped up to the plate.
Right. And Governor Sununu was asked about the ongoing mask mandate yesterday. You know, New Hampshire was one of the last states who adopted a mask mandate Back in November, already other states with Republican governors like Sununu have ended their mask mandates. But Sununu said, you know, the state's going to kind of keep an eye on number of cases, on vaccination rates, on other factors in making a decision about this. Let's listen to what the governor had to say about that yesterday.
As all of that data kind of marries together, if you will, over the next, let's say, 2 weeks to 6 weeks, something like that, I think we'll be able to make more announcements on flexibility of restrictions and things of that nature. So I think we're very close to that point, frankly.
Nancy, what do you expect sort of specifically from those announcements? I mean, what kind of flexibility might the governor actually have in mind there?
You know, I'm not sure what he's considering. It does appear that he's being very cautious. Governor Sununu was the, I believe, the last governor in New England to have a complete mask mandate in the state. And he was criticized for that quite a bit. I think he wants to be very cautious. This, you know, yesterday we had three people die from COVID-19. It's not over. Governor Sununu and Dr. Ben Chan really cautioned people to continue taking the remediation efforts to make sure we don't have a flare-up, that we can save as many lives as possible. You know, right now we've had, I think, something like 8% of the population has been fully vaccinated. We still have a long way to go.
Yeah, and you can see on our website, nhpr.org, I was looking at the charts yesterday that our reporters, our data reporter Casey McDermott and others have been spearheading. It's incredible to see the sort of the line of the population, how many have been vaccinated, the lag time of those 2 week differentials for some of the kinds of vaccines. And, you know, 8% sounds like a lot. We're vaccinating tens of thousands of people. And at the same time, you know, we have a long way to go. Nancy, just quickly, I want to ask you what you are looking out for covering for this next year or less, hopefully, of the pandemic. What stories are in the works for you?
Oh, I think we'll be on the pandemic for quite a while. Right now, indepthnh.org, we're really buried in the legislative process. You know, the session is in full swing in the House and the Senate, and we're doing a lot of coverage there. I think over the next year, there'll also be a lot more research done into how the government has handled the epidemic here. And we'll be following that as well.
Yeah, that's right. And then, Allie, I just want to ask you what you have on tap. What stories are you working on as you get started in this beat at this exciting time?
Yeah, exciting time is one way to put it. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so next week I'm really trying to work on a piece around that homebound vaccination push that we mentioned earlier. So, you know, for folks who can't easily leave their home and either are going to need transportation or actually need the vaccine to be administered to them in their home. And with that, I'm really hoping to kind of focus in on the North Country and some of the very specific challenges that they're facing as both a huge region and then also a region where people are often really geographically isolated.
Absolutely. Well, Allie, we are looking forward to it. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Nancy, thanks as always for coming on.
Oh, thank you. Great talking to both of you.
Nancy West is the executive editor of In-Depth New Hampshire, and Allie Pham is NHPR's health and equity reporter. We're going to take a quick break, and coming up, we're going to turn to the legislature and talk about controversy over bigoted remarks from lawmakers during virtual legislative hearings. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Have you been attending sessions virtually this year? What's been standing out to you? Let us know. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Or you can email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Annie Ropeek, and you're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We'll be right back. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Annie Ropeek, NHPR's environmental reporter, filling in for Peter Biello. Tuesday on The Exchange, Governor Sununu is joining us. Send your questions for the governor to exchange@nhpr.org and join us for that conversation live at 9 o'clock next Tuesday. We're turning now to the state legislature and controversy over some lawmakers' conduct in virtual hearings this session. A few representatives have taken heat for making bigoted remarks on live mics during Zoom meetings or for interrupting speakers during testimony on race and gender issues. There's also been tension between the parties on remote access to hearings, on votes, and in-person sessions. Listeners, have you been tuning into the legislature more online this session? What have your impressions been? You can call us at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. I have two guests to talk about all this. Ethan DeWitt is a reporter for the Concord Monitor. Ethan, great to talk to you.
Glad to be here.
And Palana Belkin is a Rochester city councilor and LGBTQ activist and organizer. Palana, welcome.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, a heads up that we'll be discussing some language in this section that some may find offensive or harmful. Ethan, the issue of how legislators conduct themselves during hearing was back in the news this week because of one bill at the House Criminal Justice Committee and a comment by Representative Dick Marston of Manchester. This bill would have banned the so-called gay panic defense, where someone's perceived gender or sexuality can be used as a criminal defense in a manslaughter case. So, Ethan, walk us through what happened during this bill's initial hearing.
Sure. So this bill is kind of part of a national push to, as you put it, ban this so-called gay panic defense. Essentially, it would put into statute that, a defendant in a manslaughter case would not be able to use somebody's either real or perceived gender identity or gender expression or sexuality, again, either real or perceived, as a defense in manslaughter. Particularly as a defense in, what might count as an extreme mental or emotional disturbance that might be excused by a jury. So this law would explicitly prohibit that defense from being used. And so the bill had a hearing earlier in the day when there were a number of activists who kind of spoke about the importance of stopping the defense. At near the end of the day, what generally happens is the committee often will hold a vote on kind of whether they want to recommend the bill or not recommend the bill to move forward. And that's when the lawmakers who have heard all this testimony, they are kind of able to express their own views. And that is when Representative Dick Marston, a Manchester Republican, said something that caused the whole hearing to be derailed. I can read you his quote. He was arguing that and other Republicans were arguing that the law was not necessary because there was no necessity to ban the defense because juries could make that distinction and that the Constitution, he was calling it a carve out for LGBTQ groups. And he started saying, quote, "We are all the same breed. We're all the same people. If you kill somebody, you should be charged for murder and you should be tried on it. And there's no way in heck you're going to be able to say." And then he said, "Well, because he or she was some deviant sexuality that I'm not," and he was cut off. So this was a kind of charged debate, but his comments kind of brought it to an extreme level. Again, using the phrase deviant sexuality, he was immediately gavelled down by the chairman, and seconds later, the entire hearing and kind of the entire vote came to a close. The committee was adjourned and the screen went black. So it was a kind of dramatic and for many shocking moment, and it totally derailed the business of the day.
So this isn't the first time that something like this has happened in the legislature, certainly not this session. Is that right, Ethan? What are some past examples of similar kind of moments of conflict like this?
Sure. So I would say the Zoom era is making it so that there have been a lot of tensions, particularly between the minority and majority parties over kind of speaking time and this kind of perception that certain members are not being allowed to vote that happened once this week where Representative Nicole Klein-Knight, who's a Manchester Democrat, said that, the chairman said that she wasn't sitting in her seat and that was as a result of that she wasn't able to her vote wasn't able to be counted, and that vote was later retaken. But there's been kind of tensions that have spilled out, and because of the way that Zoom is set up, they're kind of recorded And so that was definitely one of them.
Sure. So, Polana, before we ask you more about what happened this week, you're an LGBTQ activist and organizer. Tell us a little bit about your history with the state legislature before this year.
Totally. So, you know, I came in just a citizen curious in trans rights 3 or 4 years ago. Since then, I have lobbied at the State House. I've gone around with the red badge there. I've organized professionally. But this session, I'm just, you know, listening in, you know, sometimes while I'm working, and I'm, you know, trying to help organize and stay tuned to, you know, some of these LGBTQ bills, which is what, which is why I was listening to this hearing on Monday.
Sure. So what, yeah, what was going through your mind as you watched this all unfold on Monday?
It took me a minute to realize almost what had happened because I had been listening to the hearing. It was the last hearing of the day, and then they went into their executive session where they're talking about the merits of the bills and making their recommendation votes. And for the most part, the testimony was really respectful. And, you know, that was something that as an LGBTQ person, I was listening for, just trying to get a hint for maybe, you know, where are some of these newer reps at on this type of thing. And, you know, there were 300 or so people signed in support of it. Not many people signed against it. A majority of the folks that were testifying were in support of the bill. There were no odd questions asked during the actual hearing. And then, kind of like Ethan said, it kind of went off the rails really quick once they got into the executive session. I've been watching these hearings for 3 or 4 years, usually in person, but I've never seen an executive session just come to an abrupt end like that. Yeah.
So this bill had one Republican co-sponsor. He's the only gay Republican in the House, Representative Joe Alexander. He admonished Marston for these remarks on Twitter. Democrats called for Representative Marston to resign. And then a few days later, the committee voted to table this bill to take it up again next year. It was disappointing to some supporters. Polana, I want to talk a little more about the substance of the bill. What did you think about this proposal?
The panic defense. It's definitely a really complicated issue. And, you know, it's something that I think a lot of folks in here in New Hampshire think is an important thing to have on the books. The panic defense has not been used in New Hampshire yet in a trial, but, you know, I think there's 50 or 60 instances of it. Most famously, I think a lot of people would be familiar with the Matthew Shepard case 20 something years ago, mm-hmm. where, you know, defense lawyers tried to say he was murdered because of just their reaction and that it should be justified.
To Matthew Shepard being gay, right?
Yes. You know, fortunately, when this bill was tabled, there is an element of, you know, like we do have, like LGBTQ folks are part of hate crime sentencing here. So if you were to admit to, I don't know, like if you were to use the panic defense, you would be admitting to a hate crime. So that is, there's an incentive to not use that here in the state of New Hampshire. But, you know, I was definitely a little bit more tuned in again, just to hear kind of the conversation going on. This is not a bill that I was super invested in, but it was so disheartening when that conversation went awry and to, you know, like when you go and you testify in front of your legislators, there's so much trust. You're often opening up about something that's, you know, a very vulnerable thing to you. And, you know, to hear that a representative is dismissing your existence as a deviant sexuality, you know, that is just not good for trust.
Yeah. So you've been going to the State House for years. I mean, would you say that this kind of behavior and this kind of, you know, like you said, dismissal of your identity, is that new?
It is definitely not new, but what is new is that every single legislator has their own camera, they have their own microphone, and they're not able to, you know, like these thoughts don't end when they mutter something under their breath. The microphones pick that up if they're not on mute. And then it's on YouTube and people can react really quickly to it. I think that the reaction is something that is different now, too, in that you know, usually you'd be in these committee sessions in very tiny hearing rooms. There's only a handful of chair. The airflow isn't great. It's tremendously inaccessible for many folks who might live far away or have like limited transportation accessibility needs. And you can just tune in now on YouTube. We can rewind the moments. We can play them over again. It makes it easier to echo out and actually show people this is what happens. And it's not just, you know, somebody's secondhand news of, you know, oh, I heard so-and-so said this. And you're like, oh yeah, that's awful. But now we have, you know, image of it, which, you know, I think is, not to go too big, but you know, that's something that we're seeing in law enforcement reform right now, where it's like having video and being able to say, this is what is happening, grows that conversation.
Yeah, that's a really interesting comparison. I mean, what do you hope, you know, as we've seen, you know, more recordings and sort of all the sense of posterity reshaping law enforcement in the country, what do you hope happens in the legislature as they're more, you know, potentially accountable for their statements or just more aware of the sense of decorum? How would you like to see this sort of reformed in the future?
Well, it's also really difficult because New Hampshire has 400 state reps. So an instance of something like this is, you know, everyone gets upset about this rep statewide. But are people in this state rep's district, are those, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 people that voted them into office aware of what's going on? And, you know, I think, again, like last year, there were several reps who made, you know, insensitive comments on the internet. And there were really major pushes made. There were rallies held trying to get these people to resign or just to raise awareness about, you know, what their behaviors are like. And I think oftentimes that message doesn't get through to the voters. So I think that there's an opportunity there, if anything, for, you know, folks who really want to see, you know, racist or sexist legislators not hold office.
Sure. Well, Polana, we'll let you go there. Thank you, as always, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And so, Ethan DeWitt, turning back to you, you know, as Polana mentioned, Democrats especially frequently called for lawmakers at the center of this kind of controversy to resign. That's rarely happened in recent years. But I wonder how House leadership, the Republican leadership, is handling these situations. Are there any new discussions about conduct or decorum in the legislature?
Yeah, so this has kind of been unfolding for, you know, the past few months. I would say that it's just as to preface this, it's usually a turbulent time when one party takes over the House, I've noticed. I've seen a few transitions of power, and there's a lot of growing pains for both sides. But this year has been particularly acute. I think that the pandemic is certainly heightening that. There have been a few instances that have received a lot of attention. The one that kind of got the most attention was when Speaker Sherman Packard removed from a committee a Democratic representative, Representative Rosemary Rung of Merrimack. And she was removed because she had criticized, she'd written a tweet that was calling on the Hampshire police to denounce a police chief in Troy, New Hampshire, little town in Cheshire County. The chief of that town, David Ellis, had attended the January 6th pro-Trump rally. He says he only attended the rally in the beginning. He did not attend any of the violence that occurred after that. He was already on his way out. Rung was criticizing him, and kind of that set off a not Rung specifically, but Ellis's decision kind of set off a lot of controversy for the town of Troy. They closed their offices. One thing led to another. And the speaker, you know, reacted to that tweet that Representative Rung had sent by removing her from the committee and saying that she needed to apologize for her tone and apologize for kind of the content of what she said. She hasn't, you know, she's rejected the idea that she needs to apologize for her tone. But that was kind of, it was an early on sort of example of one potential way that the speaker could handle outbursts from members of both parties. But what Democrats have argued is that treatment has not extended to the same party as the speaker, has not extended to Republicans. There have been a few Republicans who have also been in, you know, some trouble for posts online. Representative Don Johnson of Laconia shared an article from a white nationalist site called the Daily Stormer The article itself was about the Georgia election, which was progressing at that time, the runoff election last month, or sorry, January.
Many years ago.
yeah, whatever January was. But it included an explicitly anti-Semitic cartoon at the bottom of it. Representative Johnson said she didn't see the cartoon when she posted the article, and she apologized for it. There was another representative James Spillane. He's a Deerfield Republican. He shared an image that was a subtle kind of anti-Semitic image, and he claimed that he didn't recognize the anti-Semitic origins of it. And these are kind of examples that Democrats have pointed to and saying, well, you know, where's the justice here? Where are their punishments? The speaker has said that those two representatives have apologized for their conduct, and that's kind of the distinction that he's drawn. But you can see how, you know, in the era of everybody being on Twitter, there are other alternative websites like Gab and Parler that have risen, where lawmakers also have accounts. And, you know, there's an incentive to be provocative in today's politics. And because of that, it becomes, you know, it's turned into a kind of policing nightmare for the speaker, and one that's drawn him criticism on both sides. But particularly from Democrats. So this week, he announced that he would kind of continue something that Speaker Steve Shurtleff, the Democratic speaker in the last session, had set up. He's creating a bipartisan committee that will review complaints. It's comprised of, I think, about two Democrats or three Democrats and three Republicans. Most of them are longstanding members of the House. And so it remains to be seen what happens kind of with that committee. But I think the idea is to try to take the decision making out of the speaker's hands, because it is one of those things where it quickly becomes difficult to establish norms as a speaker. And then all of a sudden you are asked to hold those same standards to different situations, and then the situations start to snowball. So I think this committee, I'm very interested to see how it goes. It's going to be meeting next week. And I'm interested to see whether it's just going to be, you know, a do-nothing kind of committee because there are equal parts Democrats and Republicans, or whether there might actually be some accountability.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, thank you, Ethan. And we did reach out to Speaker Packard to see if he could join us this morning. He could not. He was attending a Gopher session about COVID-19 emergency funds. That's one of the state's COVID response task forces that was also at 9 a.m. this hour. Ethan, we will leave it there for now. Always so much to talk about with you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take a quick break. Coming up, I will speak with NHPR's Josh Rogers about more of the latest in state politics. Governor Sununu has a new nominee for attorney general. His outgoing AG was sworn in as Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. And Sununu is also still grappling with the House GOP over his emergency powers. Listeners, what do you think about the governor's use of his authority a year into the pandemic? You can let us know. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, or you can email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Annie Ropeek, and you're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Annie Ropeek, NHPR's environmental reporter, filling in for Peter Biello. On Monday on The Exchange, we're talking about carbon pricing in collaboration with our climate change project By Degrees, where I'm the lead reporter. You know, I couldn't come on today without a little plug for a climate topic. I will be back on The Exchange Monday with some really smart guests and Laura Knoy to get the pros and cons of carbon pricing as a climate solution and to hear why people are pushing for it in New Hampshire. Remember, you can send your questions to exchange@nhpr.org. Right now, we're going to talk more about this week's news in Governor Chris Sununu's administration. Listeners, what did you make of the governor's attorney general nominee or the outgoing AG Gordon McDonald as the state's new Supreme Court justice? Call us now. The number is 800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And joining me to talk about this is Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Annie.
So first, in our last segment, we talked a lot about tensions at the State House over conduct between the parties during committee hearings. As someone who has been covering this for a long time, what does this moment in the legislature feel like to you?
Well, I agree with what Ethan noted about times when there's a change in party leadership creates dynamics where people are sort of learning their new roles. I do think the movement of everything to Zoom adds a layer of transparency. When you're talking about the New Hampshire House, intemperate and potentially unsavory remarks really come with the territory with a citizen legislature. The fact that it's there for everyone to see may be different. These instances have gotten more attention, and the fact that everyone can watch them is new. The fact that such utterances and such behavior online takes place really isn't.
Yeah, I do think the accessibility is really striking. I remember you used to have to sit on the floor of the committee hearings to stick your mic up in their faces, and now it's just watching from home on the computer. Josh, Governor Sununu did finally get one thing he's wanted for a while this week. Gordon McDonald, his outgoing attorney general, was sworn in as the Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. What does the Chief Justice actually do? Why is this post important?
Well, the Chief Justice is not only the leader of the Supreme Court, which has five members. It's been without the full slate of justices for 18 or 20 months now. So there's that. But the Supreme Court Chief Justice is also the administrator for the entire court system. And having a chief come in at a time when we have jury trial backlogs, accessibility issues exacerbated by COVID, Gordon McDonald may have his hands full on that front, as well as just simply helming the Supreme Court. And it's also a budget season, and having a new Supreme Court justice, Chief Justice, come in who has relationships with people at the State House, could be helpful as the governor and lawmakers set court budget.
Sure. And you have been talking to a lot of New Hampshire lawyers about this appointment. What do they expect from McDonald at the helm of the court? What kind of jurist do they think he might be?
Well, we really don't know. I mean, he has never been a judge. I mean, Gordon McDonald, certainly well-known in the New Hampshire bar and well-regarded as a lawyer, and certainly people can look at his work as attorney general. Gordon McDonald, his politics, his involvement in GOP politics as a campaign worker, as a chief of staff to former U.S. Senator Gordon Humphrey some years ago, his involvement in sort of right-leaning enterprises such as the Josiah Bartlett Center, he's a member of the Federalist Society, and his work for politicians who are seen as hostile to abortion rights certainly got a lot of attention when Democrats ran the council. And, the combination of all those things certainly scuttled his nomination when Democrats were in. And but that scuttling took place with Gordon McDonald having broad support within at least a certain set, at least a sort of a, I don't know how you want to put it, but within the senior ranks of the New Hampshire bar.
Sure.
Gordon McDonald's an accomplished lawyer, but we don't really know how he's going to rule on things until he gets there. I mean, the New Hampshire Supreme Court is a place where consensus tends to be forged among justices. There are not a lot of dissenting opinions. A lot of the opinions are unanimous. And so, people are going to look. I mean, once you put a robe on someone, you don't exactly know how they're going to act. So we'll wait and see. I mean, one issue will be is how McDonald handles recusals. He has said he's not going to touch issues that his office was involved in. And the implications of that are a little murky. Some judicial ethicists and lawyers I talked to saw McDonald's issues on this front as quite pedestrian and something that judges everywhere have to deal with. Others say this could keep McDonald out of significant matters for some years, and a lot of public policy gets made in the state, in the court system, and by the Supreme Court, from school funding to other significant matters with big impacts on everyday people's lives.
Are there particular cases that we know are in the works that he either could hear or could recuse himself from that you're expecting to come up in the next couple of years?
Specific cases, some stuff are regarding, if cases get there, regarding, law enforcement matters. And it's interesting, not simply because of his role in the Attorney General's office, and there are cases that are expected to get there involving, local police matters, whether his office's involvement could take him out of those, or also his role as helming Governor Sununu's law enforcement reform efforts So, you know, we shall see. I mean, a lot of lawyers I talked to said, you know, look, you know, Gordon McDonald was seen as a real lightning rod during the confirmation process. But plenty of lawyers, even those who don't share Gordon McDonald's politics in terms of, you know, them being Democrats, say they're not really expecting him to necessarily be someone who radically alters the complexion of this court. But you know, we'll see. We don't know until the rulings come. And, you know, it is interesting that he will be the third Supreme Court justice that Governor Sununu has appointed. So he's now appointed the majority of the court. And, you know, whatever they do on Gordon McDonald's watch, this will really bear the imprint of Governor Sununu and his ability to, or the timing of the appointments he made. And now the Republican counsel, his ability to get someone he really wanted on the court in his seat.
Absolutely. And I would be remiss if I didn't note the Supreme Court does tend to hear environmental rulemaking cases a lot of the time that I have to cover. And I wanted to note that Gordon McDonald's father is actually a bit of a father figure in American climate science. He was sort of a original government climate change scientist back in the sort of Nixon, Reagan, Bush senior era. So I'll be interested to see how that might shape Chief Justice McDonald's thinking. So are there, I want to turn now to the new Attorney General nominee who will potentially replace McDonald. Who has been tapped for that position? Tell us about this guy.
Well, it's the governor's own legal counsel, John Formella, who's 34. He was in Portsmouth. He sits on the Portsmouth Zoning Board of Adjustment. Certainly a soft-spoken presence around the state house, somebody who is obviously has the confidence of Governor Sununu. And, I will tell you that I don't know much about his legal work prior to his work for Governor Sununu. He practiced, Pierce Atwood, but he's a young guy, but this is a familiar path. I mean, a lot of New Hampshire attorney generals at one point served as governor's counsel, former Attorney General Michael Delaney, former Attorney General Kelly Ayotte. They both had stints as legal counsels to John Lynch and Craig Benson, respectively. Former Governor Steve Merrill, before he was governor, he was an attorney general, and he had been John H. Sununu's legal counsel. There are other examples. So this is a pretty standard trajectory. And again, the qualifications for becoming attorney general are having the confidence of the governor and being able to get three votes from the executive council. And you know, I would expect that John Formella will have that support. But we don't know a lot about him. And you know, he doesn't have prosecutorial experience, which, we went through a run of attorney general who did have that experience. Gordon McDonald didn't. Joe Foster, Maggie Hassan's attorney general, didn't. So, in some ways, this nomination is more in keeping with some recent attorney generals in terms of he didn't really come up through a law enforcement side.
Sure. What is the difference between the governor's legal counsel and the attorney general? I mean, it reminds me of like White House counsel versus president's lawyer versus solicitor general. Like, what are those? How are those jobs different?
I mean, the attorney general, they oversee representation of the state. The governor's counsel is really focused on the governor's office, and there is obviously some interplay between those two roles. But John Formella was deeply involved in helping the Sununu administration work on policy matters and stuff within the Sununu office itself.
And so, same question as for McDonald: are there any big issues we can expect the AG, if it's Formella or whoever, to be dealing with in the next few years? Any big cases that he might shape?
Well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, I've been, I will confess that I have watched a few YouTube videos of Portsmouth Zoning Board meetings to try to get a better sense of John Formella's, bearing in a public setting. I haven't formed any deep conclusions based on that cursory viewing, but, there are a lot of issues regarding, obviously, juvenile justice system. We had, the lawsuit this week that's been reported on by the Associated Press about abuse at the Sununu Center. There are obviously environmental matters. We have police reform.
There's lots of stuff that the attorney general is always involved in, and it'll be interesting to see what as John Formella gets a public hearing. You know, a lot of us are going to be learning more about him. I mean, he has been with the Sununu administration from day one. but he doesn't cut a terribly public figure.
Sure. So we have now been at the COVID thing for a year. The governor is still sparring with his own party in the State House of Representatives over his emergency powers during the pandemic. Josh, the House voted on a bunch of bills this week that you reported on that would limit Sununu's unilateral authority during emergencies. Tell us about some of those bills.
Well, the House, the full House, last week passed a bill that would essentially rescind sanctions imposed by the state against businesses that fail to follow state guidance. There have only been a handful of actual fines. That bill passed the full House. There was another bill that would look to allow lawmakers to override policy decisions, executive orders, essentially, that can be issued by the state's top health official, the Commissioner of Health Services. Those bills have passed the full House. You know, where those go from here is unclear. The governor is quick to criticize those, and I don't think all that many people are expecting those bills to make it to the Senate as well. But the bills that you referred to, those were passed in House. Those were referred in a House committee. Those are still being debated. But there are a number of those that would require the governor to essentially come to the legislature to get permission to extend executive orders. There's some that would undo the state of emergency. There's some that would allow the council, the executive council, to have some oversight over those and to almost have a veto role over states of emergency. I mean, the push and pull, I mean, you say it is, these bills are all Republican-sponsored. I think it's fair to say it's a subset of the House and Senate GOP caucus that might be inclined to support these sort of measures. You know, there are many Republicans who feel that the governor has overstepped his bounds. I mean, the courts have ruled that he has these powers, but that he's overstepped his bounds. Certainly Democrats, when they held the majority, felt that the governor was leaving them out of key decisions. But Republicans have been more adamant that the governor's actions are, in their view, or at least some of them, violative of the Constitution. You know, where these bills go, you know, the governor's office has been, the governor's certainly criticized some of these bills, but the tone of his criticism suggests that he's not entirely worried about them actually reaching his desk. But, you know, I think if they were to reach his desk, you could expect a veto. So.
Sure. Yeah, we'll hear from the governor in a second. We got an email from Marianne in Cornish who says the legislature should not take away the governor's powers to declare a state of emergency. Having to go through the legislative process during a true emergency is absurd. It's slow, cumbersome, and above all else, extremely political. A true emergency should not be ruled by the political whims of whatever party is in power. Marianne, thanks for that note. And the governor, as you said, Josh, did, you know, have some words for these proposals during his press conference yesterday. Let's listen to that.
That's why you call it emergency powers. It's not full time. It isn't long term. It isn't built into the Constitution to last, for indefinite years and years on end. There's a fixed time. That's why you have to keep re-upping it. Technically, the legislature could get rid of the emergency powers, the state of emergency altogether. That would be a terrible thing to do, given that we would lose all ability to apply for FEMA funding, all ability to get funding for our National Guard. I mean, the domino effect of negative repercussions there is huge.
Josh, what do you make of that? You did say that you don't think many of these bills have much of a chance of passing, but what do you think about Sununu's argument about repercussions and precedent here?
Well, I mean, the idea that
passing some of these bills could potentially put at risk federal aid tends to be persuasive. But, you know, the tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch in New Hampshire over, you know, separation of powers and kind of who's really in charge, that, you know, waxes and wanes, but it is really a core concern that, you know, animates discussion year after year in Concord. And, you know, it is true that these statutes that give Sununu these powers or any governor these powers, you know, some of them were passed in the wake of 9/11. And, you know, it is an interesting question to know what we're talking about. I mean, the case made by some of the proponents of these bills say, well, you know, we're not talking about, an invasion. We're talking about a pandemic that you know, is lasting for a long time. And, you know, might there be a way to sort of calibrate these things to, mollify some of the concerns, perhaps? The governor is absolutely right, though, that if the legislature were really serious in trying to end a state of emergency, they have the power to do that.
Well, Josh, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for all your good reporting and for coming on this morning.
Talk to you later.
I miss sitting across from Josh in the newsroom, but glad to be here today. And as a reminder, Governor Sununu is joining us on Tuesday morning here on The Exchange from 9 to 10 a.m. That's next Tuesday. Send your questions for the governor to exchange@nhpr.org and join us for that conversation on Tuesday. Listeners, thank you so much for tuning in today. Remember, you can find links to all the stories we've been talking about at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by Christina Phillips. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producers are Ellen Grimm and Christina Phillips. And our producers are Jessica Hunt and Jane Vaughn. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Annie Ropeek. Thanks so much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.